Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You're listening to Achtung Millwall.
Listening to Achtung Millwall Emergency Broadcasting Special, a public service broadcast made on behalf of the Real Millwall Fan Show and Achtung Millwall, broadcasting from South Bermondsey.
Huge welcome back to another edition of Achtung Millwall. We are turning out the podcasts like a machine here at the moment, and I want to welcome back one of my my lead men on this podcast extravaganza, Mr. Neil Fisler. Thank you for coming back on the show, Neil.
You have absolutely no problem at all, Nick. Great to be with you again.
And this was a good idea. This is actually a suggestion by Neil, listeners, which was we touched on this the other week when we spoke, Neil. In wartime, the First World War and the Second World War, of football clubs using guest players. They had kind of reduced competitions in both World Wars, didn't they? First and second. And many, many clubs, Millwall included, often recruited or had made available players for other clubs who are in the services playing locally, effectively.
Yeah, that's right. Well, a player could actually be registered with one club and was permitted to play for another club within a reasonable distance, providing the parent club obviously gave them permission. Yeah, but it was the only way that some clubs could field teams. Yeah, likes of Aldershot that were near army bases, they fielded whole squads of star players and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, they must have been quite well placed, Aldershot, mustn't they? And I dare say Plymouth and the naval bases, Portsmouth and so on. You know, for that reason, that they've possibly got a lot of star players in their service working locally or on duty locally.
Quite a lot of players that were obviously based in and around London. So well, obviously, the likes of Arsenal, Chelsea, Tottenham, the bigger clubs, snapped up a lot of the star players.
Yeah.
And the likes of Millwall and that were left to fend for themselves.
Get the crumbs that fell from the rich club's table. That's always been the way of Millwall FC ever since Victorian times, I think. But there we are. So just to set the scene for listeners, the First World War began in August 1914, and this is something I've always found quite strange, Neil. I don't know how you feel, but the professional football continued after the declaration of war. Initially, 1914-15 season was played to a conclusion with league champions and an FA Cup final. It was a very strange idea when you look back at it now, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I guess that you didn't have bombs falling and whatever else in this country, but well, I would have thought that players would have been called up and taken away, and yeah, I'm surprised that you have a whole side. Yeah, like Orient, they provided hell of a lot of players, hell of a lot killed.
Yeah, absolutely. Early part of the First World War, it was a volunteer army. As war was declared, it was still the pre-war, quite small British army. It wasn't of any great size. We were much more of a naval power in those far-off times now. War was declared in August 1914, and as you say rightly, Neil, many, many clubs, Millwall included, players joined up. There was a huge wave of volunteering in the early part of the First World War. And I did find a reference in the James Murray book, Lions of the South, how the Millwall squad, the FC, joined the Nunhead Shooting Club, which would be in Nunhead locally.
Yeah.
And some of the younger unmarried members of the first team enlisted. And the names I've got here, which You may recognise yourselves, listeners, as Bill Voisey, Sullivan. I don't have a first name for Sullivan. Wood and Leach, all members of the first team, joined up, and Leach became the first Mill player to be injured by shrapnel in one of the early exchanges in France. It's quite something, really, Neil. I mean, I know many other clubs did the same. I believe, and you mentioned Orient, I believe in Scotland Hearts, their entire squad joined up, volunteered for the front. Quite a wave of patriotism in that early part of the war.
Yeah, well, I think, a lot of them joined the Middlesex Regiment.
Yeah.
I think it was Major Buckley, wasn't it? It was something to do with them.
Was that the Footballers Battalion? They formed a Footballers Battalion. Many players would join up. Many would see action, and many would perish in those great battles of the early part of the First World War. The Den, like many other football clubs, became a match day recruitment centre to encourage young men to join up. And I found a programme reference, well, actually it's an advert, Men of Millwall, Don't Be Left Behind, Join the Army. And there was a great reference in the programme notes, which I'll quote. Now then, you young lads, looking on, looking on the football, who have no responsibilities at home, in the shape of useful work or family ties, do your bit and join Lord Kitchener's army. And as the book puts it, many did and many didn't return from France. It's quite poignant when you look at these old posters, Neil, isn't it?
There's a phase of the war. Drives home, but the whole thing, really. And I think everybody wanted to do their bit back then, didn't they?
Absolutely.
You're almost a social outcast if you didn't.
Very true. Yeah, it was hence the white feathering and all that kind of nonsense that happened at that point. The press, the London press particularly, were vehement in their opposition to professional football continuing. And there was even a bit of a press battle between Millwall Football Club, who I think took the view, rightly or wrongly, that the playing of football was a welcome distraction for the people and servicemen at home. And then, obviously by the late part of 1915, I think it was no longer viable to continue the professional game, Neil, was it? I mean, the casualty rate was mounting. The battles were becoming ever more horrendous. The weapons were ever more modern. And I think many clubs just didn't have the players available to take the field in the end, hence the rise of the guest system that followed in 1915-16.
Yes, well, we can understand why they did it. But they were struggling to put teams together. As you quite rightly say, people, players have been called up and they were just struggling.
Absolutely. I mean, the competition changed. It was Mill were still Southern League members at the outbreak of the First World War. The Football League and Southern League at that point were roughly on a par, though I think probably the Football League was the rising power in the game, and the Southern League was on its final years. But Millwall was a Southern League member, and out the Northern clubs mostly in the Football League. Those competitions were suspended from 1915-16. And something called the London Combination was formed up, which was pretty much, I imagine they would have done this in the Midlands and in the North and in the West. Local competitions didn't involve an awful lot of travelling, short distances, and pretty much friendly competitions in some ways, I suppose, when you look at those times.
Yeah, but they split them, actually. They had a principal tournament that ran between September and January, and then they had a supplementary tournament that ran from February to April.
Right.
And you just played your local teams, teams in and around the London area, including the likes of Croydon Common that actually folded after the war.
There's a name, because they're a big club. Croydon Common were listed on all of the pre-First World War fixture lists for Millwall. Quite a big name in their time, weren't they? And then, as you say, they disappeared at the end of the conflict.
Yeah, well, absolutely. Yeah, well, Millwall beat them 6-3 in 1915 in the first London combination when Yemen, I think Millwall actually finished first or second.
Well, I mean, a few notes I've taken here from the James Murray book, which is an immense body of work. And if you haven't got it, you probably won't find it other than on maybe eBay. It's out of print now, but Lions of the South is wonderful stuff in terms of the detail for these times. I mean, I've just noted how the attendances were falling there. And obviously, it's one thing to stage, effectively, it was amateur football because the professional competition had been suspended. But there was comparatively low attendances. People's lives were focused on increasingly on the war, the effort, and the munition manufacture that was going to be required in this conflict. It just didn't seem to be the time or place for football, did it?
Yeah, no, well, I've just quickly had a look up here, and I think in that first season, our two biggest attendances were actually away from home against Arsenal and against West Ham.
Incredible, yeah.
Yeah, well, at home we were getting 2,000, 3,000, 4,000.
Absolutely.
So as you quite rightly say, people were put off and they're focusing and their attentions were elsewhere.
Rightly so. I mean, as you say, the system was allowed, because the clubs were effectively amateur now, so no wages were being paid to the players. I imagine some form of, fees of some sort for travel or something of that kind, possibly. But they fitted it in with their army, or at that time, just their naval or army duties. Flying Corps was part of the army at that point. I did see that the players could share their gate receipts, which was an interesting thing. I never realised that in the London combination that there would be some kind of divvying up of gate receipts for players, I suppose, as a method of trying to keep them interested in playing for the club at that point.
I guess that they were probably under the table payments and what else going on. And the bigger clubs, your Arsenals and things like that, they would have been paying quite good money, I'd have thought.
Absolutely. I don't have any particular guests during the conflict, so you may be able to supply one or two yourself, Neil. My one Second Lieutenant Joe Dines, who was on the official war memorial. But he was actually our player. He wasn't a guest, I believe. He played for the Lions during the First World War, and then unfortunately met his end towards the end of the conflict in 1918.
Yeah, it wasn't to the same level, I don't think, as we saw in World War II.
No.
Obviously, the likes of Bert Lipson came through at that time, and his brother John actually played for Millwall.
And, did he?
Yeah, played in the early part of the war, I believe.
Okay, I didn't know that. I've seen Bert Lipson's name, or Lipson or Lipson, but I didn't know he had a brother. I didn't know he played for the Lions. I mean, the interesting story I found in Lions of the South is actually just after the conflict, 1919. The war ended in November 1918, of course. And there was still some form of this kind of guest system after the conflict had ended. And there's a player, I've only got a surname, Wilding. I don't know if you've seen this story, Neil, but Wilding scored for Millwall versus Fulham. This would be in early 1919, I guess. And then he played against Chelsea the week after, despite the fact he was a Chelsea player. He was on their books. guesting for Millwall. So he was a Chelsea player. He guested for Millwall against Fulham, then against Chelsea, and scored. He actually scored against his own club, which I'm sure would be a great pub quiz question. But he was known only as Wilding. So I don't know if that's his real name or possibly a pseudonym, nom de plume, to escape attention.
Harry Wilding. Played for Tottenham as well. He was in the Grenadier Guards, I believe, at some stage.
I've got one other World War One story, which is a nice one, also from the Lions of the South. Then we'll move on to World War Two. This is a mystery halfback who played for Millwall versus QPR in 1919 again. So in the very early post-war period, he was known only as Barry. This was a pseudonym, Barry, from a top club. In inverted commas, he was from a top club. He was known as Barry. Barry from the Top Club is inverted commas, because no one knows who Barry was. This is in the pre-picture era, I guess. And maybe the papers end in their photos of leading personalities. So no one knew who he was. He was a top player. He scored for Millwall against QPR, but his identity remains unknown, and the book doesn't enlighten us as to who Barry might have been. Mystery halfback Barry.
You're only at Millwall because you play a ringer from a club under the name of Barry.
And no one knew who he was. How can you get that situation? Anyway, scored. Barry scored. So he's our mystery goal scorer, according to James Murray's wonderful Lions of the South book. So there we are. Thank you, Barry.
Barry.
You're listening to Achten Millwall.
We'll move along to the Second World War, which was slightly different to the first conflict in that, in the football sense, in that the war broke out in September, so the football season had barely begun at that point, so it was just cancelled from the very off. There was no more of this carrying on with the season. Very different kind of warfare was going to come in 1939. Football was suspended, but gradually, Neil, you got a reversion to the amateur approach, London combinational versions of it, with guest players increasingly as the Second World War progressed.
Yeah, just as we actually, touched on, I think initially it started as like a Southwest Regional League or a South League Division A.
Yeah.
Then it moved on to a regional league again, where I think the furthest we probably played was Northampton. Yeah, but it appears if they kept on changing it every year, because then it kind of went to a London league, then a football league side. So in many respects, they were actually making it up as they went along.
I got a sense reading the James Murray book that there was some tension between the London clubs, particularly, and authorities, football league authorities, as to the structure of the competition. I mean, obviously, air raids would be a factor. A couple of games were abandoned due to German air raids in early 1940-41, and travel was very difficult at this time. You couldn't just jump on the train for no reason. You had to have a real and valid reason, and be able to justify that reason for moving around the country. So away travel would be very difficult to get organized, and I think that was part of the tension between Millwall particularly and the Football League.
You mentioned air raids. There's a fantastic game, I think it was in December 1939. Little old Millwall pitch up down the valley. People were winning 4-2 with 1 minute to go.
Yep.
The air raid sirens. Starts falling from anti-aircraft guns on top of the crowd. The crowd flying for cover. And then when the all clear was eventually sounded, the final minute was played.
Wow, they played the final minute. What stuff would they have made out of in those times, Neil? An air raid takes place, bombs are falling from the sky, death. And they still come back and finish the game. It was a different breed of people back then. I take my hat off to that whole, both generations, First and Second World War conflict. They were made from different material. I mean, that's a great story. An air raid takes place, they come back and finish the match. Obviously, there's a famous photo. You probably have seen it. It's in the Lions of the South. The Den took a pounding in 1943. Yep. Famous crater impact on the halfway line meets the Alderton Road end, the dog track at that point. Huge, great crater. And in a similar vein, a match is taking place whilst people are standing on the rubble, aren't they? I mean, they're basically standing on the halfway line terracing with half of it missing due to this huge landmine that dropped there.
Yeah, but I think that what had happened was it actually dropped in between two games. I think the amateur cup tie was due to be played after we'd played at home, and the Luftwaffe, they emptied out their bombs because obviously we were quite near the docks then, weren't we?
We were, yeah.
And one landed on waste ground and one landed slap bang in the middle of the ground.
I believe that was the air raid, which I think was in 1943. I'll stand to be corrected on that. I think it's 1943 that took place. And I believe that our manager then was Bill Voysey, who was a Millwall playing legend in his own right. That's the right word. Modern kind of word, but I'll use it for, on this occasion, forgive me. But he was also a decorated, highly decorated First World War hero in his own right, and he was injured in that bombing raid, and I think that was largely responsible for him retiring from management at that point, Neil.
Yeah, funnily enough, when I was looking through the notes earlier on, he actually picked himself earlier in the war to play in a cup tie. And
I think I read that. Yeah, he played. I mean, it was at the age of 40 something, and he was, because we were short of players for the reasons we've touched on. But Bill Voysey, I mean, I might do a show in his own right, because I think he's a name that we need to know at Millwall, because he actually held the military medal, the Belgian Croix de Guerre, and I think it's Distinguished Conduct Medal from the First World War. And believe me, listeners, you don't get any of those for nothing. You know, they're the higher decorations. A very brave man. And
yeah, but especially not then.
Absolutely. Fought on the Western Front, decorated by the Belgians and by the British. Managed Millwall. I think he played for the British Olympic team. Managed the club in the war, and was injured in this devastating air raid. It actually caused a huge amount of damage to the old den. It's a wonderful photo. I might find it and post it out with this show, because it's I always enjoy looking at that. So people standing on bits of rubble on the on the terracing.
Imagine it now, they'd have like a 20 meters exclusion zone around it, wouldn't they? And
nowadays, yeah, the place wouldn't open in the first place, would it? But there, carved from different stuff. So what we thought we'd do, Neil and I, listeners, is run through a list of guest players. People, these will be largely speaking players from other clubs who played for Millwall and in the Lions shirt, but they would have been other teams' players, really. But I'm going to kick off, if I may, Neil, and you've probably got a lot more than me, because I know how these shows work. I put up a few names and Neil floods me with 15 in response. But I'm going to kick off with a famous Millwall player, J.R. Smith, Reggie Smith, yep. Known as.
Went on to managers.
Yeah, played for Dundee. This was in 1944, October 1944. He's a Millwall player. He was stationed in the RAF. I could be wrong on that, but he was in the Dundee area. And played for Dundee versus Aberdeen in one of the Scottish local competitions. In October 1944, and that is reported by the Dundee Courier, J.R. Smith. Quite a famous player pre-war, I believe. He was an England international, I think, Neil, wasn't he? J.R. Smith?
Very, very famous. Yeah, Reggie Smith. You would be around the time of the 30s FA Cup semi-final. Division 3 South title winning side.
Absolutely. And they guested for Dundee. I don't know what the outcome of the game was, but I just found it interesting. There he was up there in Dundee, and he turned out for the Dark Blues, I believe they are, Dundee FC. What ones have you got, Neil? I've got one. You give me two, and I'll give you one in return.
Right. So players that have guested for Millwall.
Yeah.
Seaton Airlie.
Wow. Seaton Airlie.
Sorry, Airlie. No doubt.
Right.
Yeah, we know less. Played for Celtic. Cairns, Worcester City, guested for Derby, Nottingham Forest, Chelsea and Leicester. Nothing too memorable about that, but was actually conscripted to the Honourable Artillery Company.
That's okay.
And his son was the future Prime Minister, Ted Heath.
Wow, I didn't know that.
And when
Seaton Airlie.
Yep, and when he was living in the south of France playing for Cannes, he had a certain little known artist called Pablo Picasso as his neighbour.
Oh wow, that's great stuff. I like that. I mean, the mere fact he's living in Cannes, the southern part of France, is in itself incredibly stylish, and to have Picasso as your neighbour is wonderful. I can't match that. All my stories now look very drab by the side of Seaton Airlie. Oh dear. Well, I'm going to scrabble around to find my next most interesting name in return. I don't know if it's particularly interesting, but I went through the War Cup semi-final, which was Millwall versus Arsenal, played at Stamford Bridge, and I see that we had a corporal, Les Medley, who I think was a Spurs player, and I've got his Wikipedia thing here. So he was a Tottenham player. He was playing for the Millwall in the War Cup semi-final. A schoolboy England international as a schoolboy. But he would go on to play after the war in the famous Tottenham Hotspur push and run side, which won the first division in 1950-51. He won six England caps in his own right. And then strangely, it might not be strange to some, but in 1953 left to join the Canadian Soccer League, National Canadian Soccer League. Yep. He played for a team called Toronto Ulster United, which I thought was fascinating. I've never heard of Toronto Ulster United, but he played 164 games for Spurs, scored 46 goals. Les Medley, Millwall player in 1945, briefly in the War Cup.
You're listening to Achten Millwall.
Yeah, if you give me another one, I'll return fire.
Yeah, right. I just love this bloke's name. I'm going to cross out Medley on my list. Sergeant Sailor Brown, a Charlton Athletic. I bet you've got him on your list, name. You don't let names like Sailor Brown get past you.
Albert John Sailor Brown.
Yeah, Sailor was a nickname. Robert Albert John Brown, Sailor, also known as Albert Brown or Bert Brown. Given the nickname Sailor by his teammates due to his rolling gait, G-A-I-T, and muscularly stocky build. I think it's fat is probably the word we're searching for, isn't it? wonderful career. There's a picture of him on Wiki where, like every player at that era, seemed to look like they were in their 60s. You know, there's Sailor Brown, born in 1915 in Great Yarmouth. He's an inside forward. He died at the ripe old age of 93. Yep. Quite recently, in 2008, he was a Charlton player, and then post-war briefly for a season for Nottingham Forest and then Aston Villa.
FA Cup in 1946.
Yes, he would have won the FA Cup. Yeah, that's correct. He was in he was a sergeant in the Royal Air Force during the war and a member of the Greenwich Auxiliary Police. And he was left football in 1956 to retire. And worked as a bookmaker and a timber merchant. There was no retiring on your money made in football back then, there was there? It was
absolutely not.
Work as a timber merchant and do a bit of bookmaking, which I don't know if that was even legal then, but he did a bit of bookmaking at that point. But you're right, he won the FA Cup in 46.
You're respected for Villa and Arsenal as well.
So there we are. Sailor Brown played in the game I've identified, which was the semi-final of the FA War Cup 1946. There we are. Come on in, Neil. Give me one.
Sam Bartram.
Yeah, you nicked my list.
I gave you that list originally.
That's my list hold under the water. That's a torpedo beneath the waves.
Gotcha,
to coin a phrase, yes, as we're in early May.
You go on about him and then I'll chip in.
All right, Sam Bartram, famous character, I think, probably fair to say, for Charlton Athletic. 579 appearances for Charlton between 1934 and 1956. And keep in mind, listeners, that that would include 6 years of Second World War. There's a picture of him. He looks like a character, an old school footballing character, born in 1914 in Jarrow up in the northeast. Played for England in wartime internationals, but they were not, I think, treated as full internationals. He played in goal for us in the War Cup final, I believe, Neil.
He did, and went on to become a very famous football writer with the Sunday People.
Yes, he was a journalist, wasn't he?
Yeah.
After all, there's a great story on Wikipedia, which if you've got it, I'm stealing it off of you immediately, Neil. Yeah. 1947, he was playing for, I guess, Charlton in the semi-final of the FA Cup at Elland Road against Newcastle. So Charlton v Newcastle. Bartram was suffering from food poisoning, But he played with a hot poultice on his stomach. I mean, what difference is that going to make to you? It's on the outside of your stomach. You know, I can't see what, if you've got the, backdoor trots, you know, I don't know what difference it's going to make to have a poultice, poultice on your stomach. Such was the medicine of the times, I suppose.
Yeah.
He's a runner-up footballer of the year, I see, as well, at the age of 40 in 1954.
Former coal miner.
Yeah, a coal miner. Well, coming from the northeast, of course. These are, I mean, he looks like a rugged individual. I mean, just looking at the photo of him here, he's smiling at the camera, but he looks like a man that was no stranger to. He could handle himself if the game got a little rough and tough, I would think. And was he famously the one who was still the fog came in? There's a game at the Valley when it was abandoned through fog, and he didn't realise the game had been abandoned, was still in goal, even though the players had left the pitch. Yeah. He's still out there, and everyone else has gone indoors.
It's belief, doesn't it?
I've got E. Gregory from West Ham. Is that Ted Gregory?
Ernie
Gregory. Ernie Gregory, forgive me.
Ernie Gregory, the goalkeeper.
And he was a West Ham player, and he played, he covered our goal in the final. West Ham registered player, 1938 to 59. 382 appearances, Ernie Gregory.
Yeah, I think he actually served West Ham for about 50 years.
Yes, he did, yeah. All
kinds of capacities.
A tribute from former West Ham goalkeeper Phil Parks described him as a legend, pure and simple. I don't think we'll ever see his like again. He was a one-club man, a player, a coach, a manager. And he has to be the greatest servant that West Ham Football Club ever had. Ernest Gregory, 1921. He lived to a ripe old age, near 90. He died in 2012, living in Basildon at that time. And he played for England B in 1952.
Yeah, lived in Harrow for many years, I believe.
Served with the Essex Regiment and the Royal Air Force during the Second World War. So Ernie Gregory, goalkeeper in the War Cup final. Shall I come back with another one for you and see what you've...
Yeah, go on. You run through yours because I probably gave them to you anyway.
Eric Keane. Eric Keane. There it is. I've got him. Played in the semi-final, I believe, Eric Keane. He was a Hereford United player before the war. Player manager of Hereford. The only thing I found of any particular interest with Eric Keane, and you might have more on it than me, Neil, but he managed Egypt, which was a very strange move to manage Egypt in the post-war period. And he took charge of the Egyptian national side at the 1948 Summer Olympics. And it's odd because you get some footballers that travel. And he went on to manage Hong Kong in 1948, and then in Sweden and the Turkish club. And some players do this, don't they? They make a career travelling the world managing football clubs. You know, I remember Stephen Constantine at the Den a few years. He's kind of made a life managing in the Far East and the subcontinent and places like that, all over the place, you know.
Yeah, well, back then, English football was king, really, wasn't it? And our coaches were deemed to be
the very best.
The game. And so they were... So consequently, they were in great demand.
Absolutely. Managed Turkish club side Beşiktaş briefly in 1949 and 50. Eric Keane. And this is going to be my last one. George Marks, Arsenal, RAF and England. And he obtained permission to play for Millwall in playing at Southampton at the time, playing for Southampton. And this was in 1943. George Marks was a Arsenal player briefly. And then after the war, played for Blackburn Rovers. He retired as a local government officer, which seems like a very mundane way to... Having been a local government officer in my time myself, that is the most mundane way to see out a footballing career. George Marks. He played for Arsenal. He was in the famous film called The Arsenal Stadium Mystery. Apparently he was featured in that, which was shot at the Highbury Ground, and as I say, played for England in the wartime. And then after the football, we became local government officer, which seems like a drab way for it all to finish up, in my opinion.
Very patient, Matt. He spent 10 years at Arsenal. I think he only played about twice.
He was a professional reserve, I would think. For Arsenal. So that's me. That's my list.
You're listening to Achten Millwall.
Did you have any others that can top any of those, Neil?
Yeah, we might have one or two.
Go on in.
This gentleman actually only died a few months ago, a guy called Ivor Broadus.
I've heard that name. Ivor Broadus.
He was an England international. He was born on the Isle of Dogs.
Right.
And he served in the RAF line Wellingtons and Lancasters and was actually pals with stars Charlie Wood and Len Tyler. That's a name you won't forget. Yeah. Podcast with his son. He was a player manager of Carlisle. And interestingly, he once transferred himself to Sunderland when he was player manager at Carlisle. Came in for him, so he sold himself to Carlisle. He actually sold himself.
Wonderful story, isn't it? And they say football was corrupt back in the old days.
Played for the likes of Man City, Newcastle, went back to Carlisle, played for Queen of the South, managed Carlisle again, I believe, and was actually a journalist for about 50 years and settled in the Carlisle area. I think he actually died earlier this year.
Wow. Okay. Ivor Broadus. All right, Pete.
Absolutely. The next one we've got is Vic Buckingham.
I've heard that name.
Yeah, very, very, very famous manager, coach. Played for Millwall. I believe he had a couple of... He played for Millwall a few times in the war, 43, 44 and 44, 45.
Right.
But came into his own as a manager where he actually coached Barcelona and Seville.
Wow.
And he had two spells at Ajax where he spotted a young Johan Cruyff.
That's where I've heard the name, yes. I've just got him on his Wikipedia page up, as you said, and there it is, yeah. Johan Cruyff made his league debut under him with AFC Ajax. That's incredible. There's a picture of him there as well, Victor Frederick Buckingham, with a cigarette drooped nonchalantly from his lips, fedora, and a great kind of 1950s-style overcoat. He looks like a proper 50s character, you know. And as you say, that's a glittering career. I mean... He started with an amateur team called Pegasus, I see, and they were quite a big name as well, weren't they, in amateur football?
Yeah, well, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think they were actually a team made up of Oxford University players with Cambridge University players.
Yeah, something like that. And then, as you say, this exotic foreign career. I mean, he's managed Bradford Park Avenue, not so exotic. West Bromwich Albion, not so exotic. Ajax, yes, kind of. Sheffield Wednesday, then Ajax Fulham. Ethnikos Piraeus, a Greek side. Barcelona, FC Barcelona. That's wonderful. Sevilla, Olympiacos, and then finally a team called Rhodos, which is a Greek side in the Aegean. Born in Chichester. It looks like he passed away in 1995. Excuse me, I thought he was still alive. He's age 79. He passed away in the mid-90s.
He was still alive.
Yeah, it would have been a bit of a feat, wouldn't it? That would be the benefits of travel. But it was a runner-up with West Brom, with the managerial. It took them to a runners-up position in the first division. Won the FA Cup with West Brom in 1954.
Wally Boys is another one an England outside left, who scored West Brom's equalising goal in the 1935 FA Cup final.
Right.
Won the Football League Championship with Everton 4 years later and was a physical training instructor at Aldershot, so obviously was within easy distance of London.
Right.
Alongside Matt Busby, Tommy Lawton and Bert Sproston.
Some names.
You're listening to Achten Millwall.
Ron Burgess was a Tottenham Hotspurs legend. I think it's quite safe to say. Played for Spurs for years, I believe you're...
Tottenham 1938 to 54. 297 appearances, and again, say the same things we said with Sam Bartram, that would include the Second World War, so yeah. Just short of 300 appearances, 14 goals. He then went on to Swansea Town, as they were known then.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
He managed, played for the Welsh national team. So I thought he managed them, but he played for the Welsh national team 32 times. And then went on to manage Swansea, Watford, and then non-league Hendon and Harrow. As you say, quite a big name in Spurs terms.
Yeah, that's right. And actually, I think he was trainer at Fulham under his mate Vic Buckingham.
Yes, indeed. He actually won the league championship with Spurs in 1951, which will be that push and run side. There's a famous, was it Arthur Rowe?
He became general manager of Millwall.
Did he? Yeah. I didn't know that. He developed a fast-moving, movement-based style called push and run, which was quite radical in its time. And Spurs won the championship, league championship, in the 50-51 season. And Burgess was a major component of that team. He also captained the Welsh national team, 32 caps for Wales, and played for the Great Britain versus rest of Europe side in 1947.
Yeah, but he'd obviously lost his way one day and found his way to the Den to play for us.
The best decision he ever made. And his brother, Clive Burgess, was a Welsh international rugby union player, according to Wiki. So that's Ronnie Burgess, Ron Burgess, Ronnie Burgess. Good choice.
You're listening to Achten Millwall.
Right, then we've got a guy called Horace Burrows, who was an England international.
Horace Burrows.
Burrows.
Listeners will be really impressed with the professionalism of our shows. You've actually got the sounds of me desperately trying to search Wikipedia as Neil speaks, so that we sound in sync and on point. There we are. Horace Burrows. I found him. Sheffield Wednesday player, Neil, 233 times.
That's right.
And then England, three caps for the English national side.
Yeah.
He played for Mill during the wartime.
41-42, I believe, and was actually called up by the Sherwood Foresters.
Yes, he was.
And was actually shot in the arm at the Battle of El Alamein.
Wow. Wow.
Then after leaving the game, he ran a sports shop, and his son actually played for Plymouth Argyle, Adrian Burrows.
Okay. Okay, a little bit of a local connection for you there. As you say, yeah, he ran a sports shop in Sutton, in Ashfield. There we are, Horace Burrows.
Yep. The next one is Malcolm Butler. He's a very interesting character.
Okay.
Who was an Ireland international, played for Belfast Celtic, Bangor, Blackpool and Accrington Stanley.
Right.
Irish international fullback who served as a flight lieutenant navigator in the RAF and was shot down in Yugoslavia.
Wow.
Was rescued from a prisoner of war camp by a local partisan resistance.
Right.
The Nazis wanted to use him in propaganda.
Well, I suppose he's Irish, born in Belfast.
Yeah.
But the Irish were officially neutral in the Second World War. But the Germans were always trying to press on the Irish question as a means of trying to get almost like a second front going to the rear of Great Britain. So I suppose propaganda could have been useful in trying to stir up a bit of activity in Ireland at that time.
Yeah, that's right. So under orders they went and they nipped him back for him.
Wonderful stuff. Wonderful stuff. Malcolm
Guy is actually an author, and I think it was actually his son that told me the story.
That's a fantastic story. And Belfast Celtic was, just noting that name. Obviously, that's separate to the Glasgow Celtic, but they were a team that was they played in the same colours. I've just typed onto their website. They folded in 19 or dissolved in 1949, I suppose, as the the situation in Northern Ireland was starting to get towards its later years. Maybe it was just difficult for them to play there. But Malcolm Butler, born in 1913 in Belfast, Northern Ireland, died 1987, aged 75. That's quite a life, really, Neil, isn't it, when you look at it?
Like players having lives now, it's absolutely nothing compared with what some of these guys went through.
No, it isn't, is it? You know, I mean, I know you can only ever...
Stories, and you can imagine doing podcasts with him.
Well, you can only live in the times that you're born in, so that's all you've ever got, but... It does put things in perspective a little bit. To be shot down over Yugoslavia, captured by local partisan groups, and then a tug of war with the Germans and the British to get you back. It would build character. I think that's probably the best way I can put that.
One hell of a podcast that, wouldn't
it? Funny we could have got him on, but there we are. I think you see one of the reasons I like to do these shows, listeners, and it's great to get Neil on here, is because I just think that these are stories and names that need to be spoken, because hopefully this is how their names continue on. I mean, I know it's only a podcast and I get it, it's only a sports Millwall show, but I just think it's important that we tell these stories so that others can hear them, and that hopefully gets passed on further down the line. That's my motive behind a lot of these kinds of shows. So Malcolm Butler.
Yeah, but that's all that matters, and somebody, as you say, takes away a little bit of what's happened.
A bit of history. Yeah.
A little bit of history.
Absolutely.
You're shining, you're in lockdown, so why not learn a little bit of history?
And he actually played, just going back to Malcolm Butler, there's one little line here. He played for Ireland in their 3-1 defeat to Wales in 1939 March, which was the country's last match before the Second World War broke out. The Irish national team was always a confusing thing back then, because you had... Ireland was what we would call Northern Ireland now. It was also the Republic of Ireland, which would be the Irish Free State, I think, to get it.
That's
get
right.
my terminology correct. And I'm sure if any Irish listeners are being offended by anything I've said, I apologise if my naming regime is wrong. But I think it was the Irish Free State or ERA, Ireland, many, many names, many different formats of Ireland. But... And I think Irish players could play for either version of Ireland. You know, you could choose to play for the North or the South, depending on your allegiances or personal choice, so to speak.
Yeah, preferences or whatever, yeah. Absolutely.
There we are. So he played in the last Irish game, whether that's the North or South, I don't know. But that was the last Irish match before World War II broke out. Malcolm Butler.
You are listening to Achten Millwall.
Guy with an interesting name. Jumbo Jack Chisholm was known.
Jumbo Jack Chisholm. I'm typing this into Wikipedia as Neil speaks. There it is, Jumbo Jack Chisholm.
Very interesting character. Useful. Yeah, he was actually a useful cricketer and could have actually featured on our cricketers podcast, because he actually played once for Middlesex in 1947.
There he is, Jack Richardson Chisholm, born in Edmonton. 1924, passed away in 1977, age 52, quite young, really, centre half. And he played 1946, 47 for Spurs.
Yep.
Keen cricketer. Yeah, you're right. He played for Middlesex, 1947, alongside Compton and Edrich, Bill Edrich.
Yeah, but he was actually a player that Millwall tried to sign, I believe, from Sheffield United.
Right.
And the deal fell through, because I don't think we were offering them enough money. We probably offered them a couple of huge guys.
Something's never changed, do they? Something never changed. There is, yeah, Irish Guard in the Second World War. He's a member of the Irish Guards, and signed for Spurs in 1947, then Brentford, as you say, and finished up at Plymouth in 1949 to 54. As it says here, his ability to inspire his more talented Argyle teammates into action, and his defensive ability made him an integral part of the team. And the Pilgrims were Plymouth crown champions 1949, I think that is. It's not written terribly clearly. I love this line, though, Neil. He's talking about Jumbo Jack. His lifestyle wasn't ideal for a professional athlete. There's a lot in that sentence, isn't there?
Yeah, but I can fill in a little bit more, believe it or not.
Please do, because he says he enjoyed having a pre-match drink at the nearby Britannia Inn. I take it the Britannia is near to Home Park.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
That's a sentence I love. His lifestyle wasn't ideal for a professional athlete. Yeah,
enjoyed the fairer sex, shall we say? He did a 5 or 6 part series on his life in the People in the mid 60s,
right?
Where he actually admitted to match fixing. we were quite open about how people would give him a brown envelope and have him such practices and how he used to meet up with the director, with the daughter of one of Plymouth's directors on a regular basis. And
wonderful character.
Just a character and a half. Absolute character and a half. And all the time he wouldn't actually move his family from London down. I wonder why.
I mean, I'm just looking at his photo. I mean, there's a photo on Wikipedia. Sometimes you can look at a face, even though this is taken in the 1950s, I guess, and you can see what's the word? It's like a roguish charm to the bloke. You wouldn't want to mess around with him. You can see that he's. You can see how he'd have a way with the ladies, and you could probably find yourself liking him, even though he probably caused mayhem in your own life. But you could help but like him.
Yeah, and went on to actually manage Romford. Yeah, but he actually admitted to match fixing when he was managing. they didn't ban him, which is even more amazing.
I mean, again, it says he left a mark on everyone involved with the club, and I think that's meant both roguishly and sentimentally, I think, probably the best way I can put it. He left a mark on everyone involved with the club, Plymouth, and is remembered to this day. In his honour, the club named a hospitality suite at Home Park after him, called the Chisholm Lounge. He died in Leytonstone in 1977. So what a character. They've got him listed on the website, the Plymouth Argyle Hall of Fame. Won the Football League third championship in 1951-52. That was with Plymouth Argyle. What a character. Jumbo Jack Chisholm. That's a wonderful, wonderful story, Neil.
Right. I can't really tell them. Yeah, but that one was the next one. It's George Eastham.
George Eastham. Oh, well, he's a name. George Eastham is a name, but maybe not quite so flamboyant as...
This is George Eastham Senior.
Senior, okay.
His son was, of course, George Eastham, who played for Arsenal in England.
Yes, he did, yeah. He
was responsible for the freedom of movement for footballers.
Yeah, he's one of the kind of contractual rebels, wasn't he? Was that Jimmy Hill who led that as well?
I believe he was chairman of the union and whatever else.
So George Eastham Senior, who was the Millwall War guest, father of George Eastham Junior,
England inside forward.
Yes, he was born in South Africa. Interesting. Oh no, he died in born in Blackpool. Died in South Africa, aged 85 in 2000. Just to illustrate the whole point of the show is that players will play for various teams wherever their service took them. I mean, George Eastham Senior, although a Blackpool player, played for Birmingham, Bolton, Brentford, York, Mansfield, Millwall, and QPR. It's quite a variety when you look at it, really, isn't it, over the course of the 6 years?
Wherever you were posted, you could virtually get a game, couldn't you?
Pretty much, yeah. I suppose you just turned up with your boots and said, I'll play, you know. And he also managed in Northern Ireland, Ards in Northern Ireland, Accrington Distillery, and Hellenic, which I think is South African, yeah. Greek side in South Africa. George Eastham Senior, wonderful stuff. Father of George Eastham Junior, probably more famous of the two.
Then we'll go on to Willie Fagan.
Willie Fagan.
Who won He won the league with Liverpool in 1947.
Fagan, there he is. Yes, there he is.
In 1937, I believe in 1950. You'll correct me if I'm wrong.
He was a Celtic player. Then he moved to Preston. Liverpool, 1937 to 1952. So again, that, as we keep saying, that would include the Second World War period. Then briefly Distillery in Northern Ireland, finished his career playing for Weymouth. He was an unofficial Scottish international in 1945. I guess in those war victory internationals that they had. After hanging up his boots, Neil, he became a ball still officer. That's a grim old profession, isn't it?
Well, first of all in Portland, and then I believe he moved to Wellingborough.
He became a ball stall, which was like a approved school. I don't think they have. There's like a youth offenders kind of. I think the ball stalls, as they were, was faded out and faded away. But when he was at Preston, he was linked with Frank O'Donnell, Hugh O'Donnell, Celtic Basin, future managerial great Bill Shankly, within the same team at Preston. And as you say, they went onto Liverpool post-war.
You're listening to Achten Millwall.
The next one on my list is actually Hung Ying Su.
Hung?
Yeah, he was better known as Frank Su.
Frank Su. That's easier. S-double-O, I guess.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
There it is. Frank Su. Yes, he's a... That's an interesting character. A mixed race Chinese and English professional footballer, born in Buxton in 1914.
That's right.
Wow.
We're apparently the first player of Chinese origin in the Football League.
Yeah.
Chinese sailor, and was actually the first non-white player to represent England when he won 9 wartime caps. Apparently. Wow.
Inside left, he played half back, was like a midfielder left kind of position, I guess, inside left, half back. Frank Su started his career with Prescott Cables in non-league, so then Stoke City, and that would be through the wartime period, 1945. He then moved to Leicester and Luton Town and played, as you say, Neil, for the England national side war team during 1942-45. And some managerial credentials as well. Managed in Scandinavia and Norway, Sweden.
52 Olympics.
Yes, he did. Coached Norway at the 52 Olympics. What an interesting character. You sometimes think there's a whole show to be done on these individuals. I mean, as you say, his birth name is, I can't even pronounce it, Kwang Su. Ah Kwang Su, but he was known as Frank for obvious English-speaking reasons, thankfully. He was an air gunner in the... that was his brother. Ronald was killed in service as an air gunner in 168-166 squadron in the RAF. And he married a hairdressing salon proprietor, Beryl Frieda Lunt, in Stoke-on-Trent in 1938. A couple... honeymooned in Bournemouth. None of your Caribbean, Mauritius.
Man, was that?
No. Frieda was. This is interesting. I mean, Frank is interesting in his own right. But she was a keen autograph hunter. So she introduced herself to Su simply to ask for his signature. And they married.
It's not bad, that is it? Yeah. But... Yeah. Yeah, there's one or two footballers now that probably do the same thing, but
Su was quick and intelligent, and noted for his ability to deliver perfectly placed passes. Stan Mortensen wrote that in his book, his autobiography, that Su was one of the best four wing halves he ever played with. To quote him, he seemed incapable of a clumsy movement. So that's quite a nice footballing. Tribute, I think. They only he managed in Scandinavia post-war. Frank Su.
Right, my next one is George Ernest Wilkins, father of Ray Wilkins.
Oh yes, there he is, yeah. Ernest George Wilkins was a professional footballer and had 4 footballing sons, including Ray. Yeah. George was born in Hackney, worked as a lorry boy, played for Hayes, and then signed pro for Brentford in 1938. He played for Brentford during the war, including a War Cup final, and for the Lions at some point during the course of the war too, in that case, Neil, as a guest.
39-40, I believe.
Served in the Royal Kent Regiment, and then continued with Brentford after the war, but moved to Bradford Park Avenue. There's a team that no longer exists, famous old side, Bradford Park Avenue, and then moved to Forest, Nottingham Forest and Leeds. And he had three sons, Graham, Wilkins, Ray and Dean. I think both Graham and Dean were both professional footballers as well, Neil, weren't they? Chelsea and QPR, am I right?
Played for Chelsea, I believe.
Winner of the London War Cup, 1941-42 with Brentford. And a guest for the Lions early on in the Second World War.
You're listening to Achten Millwall.
Very famous name, Ron Greenwood.
Ron Greenwood. Wow, West Ham legend, I think.
Yeah.
And I think probably rightly so.
England manager.
England manager. 1982 World Cup, I think he managed England, didn't he?
That's right.
Ron Greenwood. Played... As his playing career, he's playing. I suppose he must have played as in the wars, guesting. His professional career for Bradford Park Avenue. There's that name again. In 1945, then Brentford, Chelsea, and Fulham. And then obviously as a manager, quite a long period. I mean, you don't get management of this. I suppose Arsene Wenger's the nearest you get in terms of longevity. But he's 1961 to 74, manager of West Ham. At England briefly in 77 to 82, well, not briefly, but 5 years in 77 to 82. I remember the 82 World Cup where it was England. That was the first time we qualified since the 1970 tournament, wasn't it? And we went to Spain.
Wasn't it? Yeah, and I think didn't Paul Mariner or somebody score after about 20 seconds of a game? And
that's right. And we got to the strange tournament. So we got to the semi-final stage, which is like a group system. And I think we came quite close, but not quite good enough to get through to the final that in that tournament. But I'd say he's one of the more, apart from Alf Ramsey, obviously one of the more successful England managers in many ways, because he took us as contenders into the final stages of the major competition.
Yeah, but didn't we have a bulldog as a mascot or something?
British bulldog. Yeah, we had the
my favourite England kit, the white top with the red and shoulders and
the admiral. The admiral top, it's like a stripe across the shoulders type of look, wasn't it?
That's right.
And of course, you know, I mean, we are not here to we're the damn West Ham, not to praise them, but Ron Greenwood, guest player from Millwall, did instigate the development of the World Cup winning trio, Bobby Moore, Jeff Hurst and Martin Peters, as well as winning the FA Cup a couple of times. European Cup Winners' Cup, sorry, in 65.
Let us forget the fact they won the World Cup in 1966, apparently.
they had a part in it. There were other players in that team too, I recall. notably the Charlton brothers, who may have had more of an influence, but there we are. Yeah. And there we are. Ron Greenwood is inducted into the English Hall of Fame, Football Hall of Fame in 2006. And probably rightly so. I think in all fairness, I know that there'll be people enraged by these words on a Millwall show, but there we are. We have to speak fairly.
History is different.
History is neutral, isn't it? History is neutral.
That's right.
He won a first division winners medal as a player for Chelsea under Ted Drake, 1954-55.
Yeah, the Drake Ducklings, I believe they were called.
Yep. Ron Greenwood, there we are. And he died in 2006, aged 84.
Yep. Decent story behind our next one. That's Charlie Livesley. I'm not sure he had a great playing career. His father played for... His father, Joe, played for Sheffield United, Arsenal and England. He had brothers that played the game. His cousin played the game. He served as... a squadron leader in the RAF.
Wow. Okay.
Played for he played for Doncaster, Manchester United, Chesterfield, Torquay, and Crystal Palace. Guested for Millwall, York, and Stockport before going on to a coaching career in Holland and Spain. And then he moved to Torino.
Torino. Wow.
And he was actually killed in the Supergar air disaster in May 1949,
age 37. Wow. Charlie Livesey. I can't find anything on him at the moment. Haven't produced anything on him, but that's quite a story.
Yeah, Leslie Livesey,
that's probably why I'm looking for Charles Livesey.
I'm distracted by something out the window.
Leslie Livesey, there he is. Supergar, that's right, Place of Death, Supergar, which was a famous... Torino side died pretty much in that air crash, didn't they? That's an interesting story. He's a parachute trainer in the RAF and a dispatch officer. Managed in Holland at Heracles, and then moved on to Italy and coached the Italian national team at the 1948 Summer Olympics. So RIP Leslie Livesey. It's an unusual spelling. 1911 to 1949.
Finally, probably the biggest name, I think, that played for Millwall in World War II was Tommy Lawton.
Tommy Lawton played for us? I didn't know that. Wow.
Yeah, part of the Tommy Lawton's biography, believe it or not. The family biography. They listed all of his clubs and left off Millwall.
Nothing changes, Neil. Nothing changes, mate.
Yeah, but just the sheer embarrassment of a couple of times. He needed a game and probably based in older shots. And
there we were. Yeah, there we were. Tommy Lawton, one of the great names of English football, I think it's fair to say, Neil.
Great name of English football.
Yeah, 420 league appearances, including the Second World War period. We keep saying he was playing pre-war for Burnley and Everton, and then post-war Chelsea, Notts County, 151 appearances for Notts County, Brentford, Arsenal, and Kettering in the late 50s. English international. I mean, again, his England career is probably blighted by the fact that the war got in the way. 1938 to 48, made 23. Got 23 caps, 22 goals. That's quite a scoring record, isn't it?
Actually one of the most lethal goal scorers this country's ever produced. I think he scored about 260 goals in about 430 appearances, which is unbelievable strike rate.
And it's Wikipedia, Tommy Lawton was widely regarded as the finest centre forward of his generation. He boasted a strong physique, good ball control, as well as a great passing range and a powerful shot. He considered himself a two-footed player, although he's naturally right-footed. His greatest strength was his ability to head the ball, as his muscular legs gave himself a strong jump and long hang time. Stanley Matthews, no less, surmised that quite simply, Tommy was the greatest header of the ball I ever saw, and he was never booked throughout his career. So strong, good ball control, great passing range, powerful shot. Never booked. No wonder he never made it at Millwall, Neil. Not our kind of player at all.
Yeah, you can imagine the first missed header.
We like him a lot less talented and a lot more vicious in temper than it sounds Tommy Lawton was.
Yeah, that was the highlight of his career was the few games that he actually played for us. I'm sure he'd tell you.
Absolutely. And I mean, again, just to close us off, there's a little insight into the different era of football back then after his playing career. Given this was one of the finest players the country's ever produced, in my opinion, he ran a pub. He ran the Magna Carta Public House in Loudon, which I think it might be up north somewhere.
In Nottingham.
And was in the pub trade for 4 years.
Wrote for the Nottingham Evening Post, and actually, I believe, died skint. Yeah, certainly for the latter part of his life, was on his downers.
Incredible. Mentions here the period on unemployment benefit. This would be in the 1960s. You know, legend of the game on unemployment. I know, you know, not all of them finished up in that particular dire strait, but it's just strange, isn't it? Did a little bit of criminal problems as well, I think money related, in the 70s. And he died in 1996. his ashes are donated to the National Football Museum. I don't know. They must have spread them, so I don't know what you do with these ashes, but still, there we are.
You leave your ashes to a museum so people can go and gawk all over them.
I shouldn't laugh, should I? It sounds like a dramatic thing to do, but I mean, I don't know what I'd do if I was at a museum. What are you going to do with the ashes? You've got to bury them. You can't leave them up for people to look at. He starred in a film, Neil, called The Great Game, alongside Thora Hird and Diana Dawes in 1953. And Diana Dawes, for younger listeners, was Britain's answer to Marilyn Monroe.
Yes, wow. And
so he was also on TV later in his career, What's My Line? And published a few books, Soccer the Lawton Way, and all his all-star football books. So quite a character. I think probably that's the best way to say Tommy Lawton was some character.
Legend of the game.
Yeah, first division top scorer in 1937, 38, 38, 39. And then third division South top scorer in post-war 1949 to 50. And he's in the Hall of Fame, rightly so, I think. England international, Tommy Lawton. Neil, that is wonderful stuff. That's a great one to finish off on, actually, because he's a major, major name of the game. Fascinating list of names, different careers, different storylines, all brought together at Millwall through the wartime. It's quite something that the war could produce this kind of tumult and the range of characters that have played for us over those years.
Yeah, no, it's quite poignant, really, isn't it, that little old Millwall have pulled together all of these people and we're quite really that most of them have been forgotten.
Well, hopefully we've done something to mark their contribution, and I think that's really what I wanted to achieve, as I've said already. So that is wonderful stuff. Neil Fissler, I really, really appreciate that. There's some great names in there, and I'm going to get you back again. You know I'm going to get you back on the show again at some point, because I just love this kind of stuff. So
yeah, no, I love talking about this kind of stuff. But it just breaks the monotony and everything else of everything going on at the minute, that you can just escape, and you can escape into
times past. Absolutely, absolutely wonderful stuff. Big thank you, Neil Fissler. Thank you for that, and stay tuned, listeners, for more podcasts of this ilk. All the best. Arrivederci, Millwall.
Achtung Millwall and The Real Millwall Fan Show are the number one Millwall podcast, and we want to hear from you. So get in touch with us. Let us know your thoughts, your views, your rants about all things Millwall. We've got email, achtungmillwall@gmail.com, all one word, achtungmillwall@gmail.com. You can get in touch with us and leave us a voicemail on 0208 144 0232. That's 0208 144 0232. Leave us a voicemail. No human will be involved in the receipt of your message. So give us a shout, tell us what you think about all things Millwall, and the best messages will be read out on air.
Achtung, Mehlball.